Hi everyone, and welcome to the Cancer Researcher podcast from the European Association for Cancer Research. In this episode, there's always more than just one way, the third episode of our very first podcast season, we will take an overall look at the career progression in academia, exploring not only the well-known PhD, postdoc, PI route, but also how one can combine clinical practice with research. I am your host, Dr. Alexandra Bojtor, Scientific Officer at the European Association for Cancer Research and a former early career researcher myself. And my guests for this episode are Dr. Elaine Mardis, Professor of Neurological Surgery at The Ohio State University and Co-Director of the Institute of Genomic Medicine at Nationwide Children's Hospital in the US, and Dr. Carlos Caldas, Professor of Cancer Medicine at the University of Cambridge and Senior Group Leader at the Cancer Research UK Cambridge Institute in the United Kingdom. Elaine and Carlos, welcome to the EACR podcast, and thank you both for joining me today. I was wondering whether you would mind if we were to start from the very beginning. I'm sure that all our listeners are eager to find out the recipe for success, to find out how you ended up to be who you are today. But if you would allow me, I would like to start from the very beginning. And my first question would be, what determined you to do a PhD in the first place?
Well, coercion, really. I mean, I've never been one of those people who sort of had a plan in mind, other than that I knew from a very early age that I wanted to be a scientist. I wasn't really sure what that even meant when I was, you know, 4 or 5, but certainly those seeds were planted. And ultimately, for me, it was having the person who was eventually my PhD mentor as a biochemistry professor when I was a senior at university, and just having the whole world of molecular biology sort of opened up to my eyes by his lectures kind of put me in the place of starting to have conversations with him. I was planning to go and do a master's degree in genetic counseling, and he basically talked me out of it and asked me to do a PhD in his laboratory. So for me, that was the transition point and the decision point.
That's amazing. Did you always want to pursue a career in academia then? Did you know that was what you wanted from the very beginning?
I always knew that I wanted to be involved in science. That was sort of my generic description. I didn't really know what that meant necessarily at the time, but I think I've just sort of had a series of happy accidents throughout my career, and that was really one of them. So I say that a lot because I do feel like, you know, there are different types of people, and that's fine, but I don't feel like people necessarily have to come to science with a, you know, predisposed notion of being within scientific or academic research. That can develop sort of later in life and may be a consequence of the things that have gone on before. And I also don't feel like it's necessary to have a plan in mind.
No.
Right? Sometimes when you have everything sort of carefully charted out and then something doesn't work, it's like a showstopper. So this can actually be a negative thing as well as a positive thing, you know, whereas people say, oh, you've got it all planned out. That's really nice. But that's not always the case.
Well, in my case, I'm a physician scientist. So I first trained and have continued to practice as a doctor. So I went to medical school, etc. And, you know, I'm from a different era. So I did medical school in Portugal and did the American Embassy exam. Then I went to the United States and ended up in what I would consider a cathedral of molecular medicine, UT Southwestern in Dallas.
Yeah.
And I was actually the last resident on the ward 3 years after he won the Nobel Prize of Michael Brown. And, you know, Goldstein and Brown got the Nobel Prize together for discovering the cholesterol receptor. Neither of them had a PhD. And by the way, Bert Vogelstein, who was, you know, one of my mentors when I then moved to Johns Hopkins to do cancer training in medical oncology, he also didn't have a PhD, and I don't have a PhD, okay? So I went into science because I realized that, you know, disease is ultimately, you know, a disruption of molecular mechanisms of normal homeostasis, and so in order to understand disease, you have to understand the molecular mechanisms. And so that's what took me into the science path. And actually, the influence of individuals, Elaine already mentioned it. You know, I said Southwestern in Dallas, UT Southwestern, was a cathedral of molecular medicine. I really mean it. There were lots of individuals that I could name, but in my case, the big influence was Michael Brown himself, who basically influenced me to really seek very basic science questions instead of just going on a path of, you know, clinical medicine and clinical research. Not that there is anything wrong with clinical research, but he actually stimulated me to look at, you know, ultimately cancer is a disease of genes and proteins, and you needed to understand it at that molecular level in order to advance, and that's what I decided to do.
Yeah, and if I could riff on that for just a minute, I mean, I think you and others who trained in medicine really come to that pursuit from a very pure perspective because you experience patients in your day-to-day. And I would actually encourage people who have or are pursuing PhDs to get a flavor of that.
Oh, I echo that.
It can be incredibly motivating.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. No, I completely agree with you in that respect. But I have to say that, you know, I don't know if I'm an outlier or not. I am very much driven by curiosity.
Sure.
And, you know, I think that to advance in biomedicine, you really have to continue to support basic science. I think it's very important that we really continue to support basic fundamental discovery-driven science, because otherwise translational research will dry out very quickly.
Yeah, I completely agree. I do think that those pursuits can be very inspired by and flavored by being in touch with the medical questions that are at hand.
Yeah.
But going back to what you've said earlier, so do you think it would be a good idea to have like clinical practice included in during your PhDs or postdocs if the subject you are studying is related to disease like cancer research or neurodegenerative diseases or whatever is related to diseases? Or do you think it would be a good thing for someone to volunteer in a hospital on a day-to-day basis to help around just to get a feeling of it?
I think either could be very helpful. I think probably contextually in the course of studies, you know, as Carlos and I were just talking about last week in Portugal, right, we live in such an interdisciplinary world now in terms of cancer research, which is all for the better, right? But it does emphasize that we can't all come to the table with a basic question that isn't informed by other perspectives. So I do feel like at some level, whatever level that is, it can't be bad, because I always fundamentally worry about what I call research in a vacuum. If you're pursuing something, whether it's a computational question or an experimental question, if you don't take into consideration the reality of that disease or, you know, that question in terms of the patients that are involved, it doesn't have to be cancer even, and the consequences of their disease diagnosis, etc., I think that's just absenting yourself from that question in context. So to me, that's research that is uninformed. And I feel very strongly that research should be informed by context. And so however you need to get that context, that's what you really should do.
Yeah, and there is no universal recipe of how to
right.
do that. It can be done as when you are an undergrad, or it can be done
yeah.
later. It can be done through interacting with people that act as mentors on this.
Mm-hmm.
It can be simply to be involved in open days where you're showing research in a hospital environment. There are many ways of doing
clinical
that.
Shadowing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So I'm glad you've mentioned mentorship. Is it something that played a crucial role in your career progression, having a mentor?
Well, I'll start with my experience. I'm sure Elaine will have hers. That will be equally informative, if mine is informative at all. I think you look up to people that are role models. I am not convinced that formalized mentorship programs are particularly successful.
Mm-hmm.
It is about creating an environment and having sometimes individual people that that really touch you in a particular way and influence your decisions or the way you look at things. So I've been very fortunate. Medical school in Lisbon, I had those people. Then I went to UT Southwestern. I'm not going to repeat the imagery that I've used to qualify the place, but really an amazing place in Dallas, but with several Nobel Prizes, several members of the National Academy of Sciences, and really quite a fantastic environment where you were expected to provide outstanding patient care, but then to also really be encouraged to understand molecular mechanisms of disease. And then at Johns Hopkins, again, I was very fortunate to be around Vogelstein at a particular time, you know, he's been amazingly productive all of his career, but that, at the time that I was there, you know, P53 as a tumor suppressor gene, identifying APC, identifying mismatch repair, molecular diagnostics, all of those things were happening right there and then. So I was right at the thick of action, and that was really amazing. So yes, mentorship is important. I have my reservations about organized mentorship programs, although I think you have to foster an environment where people that are less young, like me, of course, Elaine's very, very young, so I'm not going to bring her into this, where people that are less young than me, they are always prepared to be available to younger people and to give advice and to provide an example on the way they conduct themselves, they do their science with curiosity, with rigor, etc. So I think that, yes, I'm all for mentorship, but I think mentorship comes from an environment more than having organized mentorship schema, but maybe I'm wrong.
No, I agree, and you're very kind, but I think I'm actually slightly older than you are. Anyway, the point is, yes, mentorship, I think, is more of an organic process, and it's an observational process. You know, it doesn't even have to be active. It can be passive. Yeah. As you said, observing people who uphold very rigorous science, who are open to questions and to offering advice when asked, they take the time, that sort of thing. It can actually be very informal but very effective.
Forgive my question, but if the whole mentorship process is to be passive, wouldn't that run the risk to sort of exacerbate the imposter syndrome? Because then you just see that person, just the career of that person, everything they've realized, but you don't really have access to their personal life. You don't really have access to their failures, because everyone has, I imagine, some,
well, maybe not necessarily failures, but sometimes things don't go exactly how you've planned. And if you, if in this process you're just passive, wouldn't that
maybe have a negative impact on you to some extent?
It could, but I feel like if you're motivated, that's really all you need.
Right.
So failures will happen. They happen to all of us. But to me, that's an internal drive to continue to succeed, to pick yourself up and go forward. You know, certainly people can be inspirational in that regard, but at the end of the day, it comes down to yourself and your own motivation, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think, of course, if you decide to come into academic career in science, if you can't deal with failure, then it's not for you.
Right.
Because I think we have to cope
yeah.
with rejection, with the third reviewer syndrome, et cetera, et cetera. So.
Our theme is always science is hard.
Yes,
yeah.
indeed.
And that can mean many things, all of the what you've just stated and more.
And on that note, have you ever had to deal with rejection during your career, and how did you handle that?
Usually not well.
Well, you know, of course. You know, when you know, rejection of papers or rejection of a career move or a grant, absolutely, and you've got to be prepared to deal with it. And you made the point earlier, and I think you are right. You know, there is a risk in just looking up to people to think that life is rosy and it's all about success and it's all about recognition by your peers. You know, I remind people, even look at the history of science and think, you know, even great discoveries. So, for example, in neuroscience, and I'm going to be controversial here because it's not cancer science, I can be more controversial. You know, one of the greatest advancements in neuroscience was the ability to look at cells individually. And that required what's called
chromogenic staining,
was originally invented by Golgi, but then the guy that adjusted it to brain cells and parenchyma was Harmonica Hall.
Okay.
And Harmonica Hall was this very shy guy that was very determined. And, you know, he just had to deal with rejection
for multiple years. And eventually he was accepted to go to a meeting with a poster or something, or the equivalent of a poster,
we're talking about, you know, more than 100 years ago. And eventually some people came and looked at it, and they realized that this guy had done something really quite extraordinary. But until then, if he didn't persevere, you know, and people now think of, he got the Nobel Prize, as people know, and it's considered one of the godfathers of neuroscience. But, you know, he had to deal with failure for many years,
before he was recognized by his peers. And so he had to persevere. And that's just one story. I could tell you others.
So, you know, looking at the history of science, I think is one thing that is very important. And people sometimes fail to do.
Yeah, completely agree. It's inspiring on many levels. And certainly that's not the only example of someone who was way out there ahead of the crowd thinking, you know, out of the box, ended up being right, but, you know, went through a lot of rejection, etc. I think the other thing to say about rejection is that it actually is a, I think, in many ways, a valuable time to consult others and sort of understand, especially a failed grant proposal, let's just say for the sake of argument, understand sort of what is it that I'm not doing well or right, or, you know, what could I do better, right? In an ideal world, you get that kind of feedback from the review. That's not always the case. And so I think, you know, early stage career, if your grants are not getting funded, that's really a setting where you can benefit from the experiences of others who have been successful in that regard. I would say that really requires you to be open to criticism and to accept that and to take it on, because otherwise it's not worthwhile to get that feedback.
I totally agree, and that's amazing advice. But at the same time, dealing with rejection, that constant improvement, that constant working on yourself and on your research can at times feel overwhelming for some people. And I was wondering whether you have some advice to researchers who feel particularly overwhelmed.
Well, I think the most important thing for someone starting their career is to pick the right environment and to pick the right type of place for them and for the way they are as a person and as a scientist. But I would say that the great test is to look for places that want their junior faculty to succeed. And so you can have metrics of that. Look at the last 10 years. People that were recruited, have they made it to tenure? Yeah. Have they been supported properly? Because the environment is, I would say, as important as anything else. And the environment is the environment with your colleagues on the faculty that will be more senior than you if you are a junior PI, but it will also be the environment that will attract the best students and postdocs. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, don't pick places just because they offer you great packages. Yeah. Go and look in detail and spend the time and really do your due diligence properly. Look at what has been the success rate of the last 10 or 20 junior PIs that were recruited into that place.
You know, I would agree with all of those things. And I would add one thing, and that is another critical component of the environment is how much grant application support is provided. Yeah. That is so critical, and a lot of places just do not do it well. So is there someone who's looking out for requests for applications that may be right up your alley and letting you know? So watching over, there are even services that do this now, but you still need someone to funnel it towards you.
Yeah.
Firstly, and then secondly, what amount of support is available there for you to put together the budget that you need and fill out all of the other necessary paperwork that's mundane, but critically important for getting the grant submitted on time, etc. So that's a really important part, but maybe not one that people necessarily investigate when they look at a faculty position.
And when do you think would be the best time to start investigating these? I would assume that when you start your PhD, you're probably a bit too naive to start thinking about this, and it's unlikely that you know exactly what you want from your career. But when would you start looking at these sort of things? When you start your postdoc or like second postdoc, when you start applying for fellowships, when do you think would be the best time to look
at this? I think when you start looking for faculty positions is really what you want. You know, it's a good question to ask as you're interviewing, I would say, for faculty positions. When you're talking to other faculty members in the university where you've given your job talk and you're thinking that all of the boxes look like they're being ticked, this is one thing to sort of drill down to on the one-on-ones that you have with existing faculty members and say, tell me honestly, what amount of grant support is here? What has your experience been in submitting grants?
Yeah.
Easy stuff.
I completely agree. And I think, you know, the career is an apprenticeship in a way.
Mm-hmm.
So during your PhD, the focus should be of learning what it is to be a scientist and the scientific method.
Then when you pick a postdoc, you need to start thinking about really what you would like to do for the next 15 or 20 years, and you're getting a first taster of it. And then,
you know, there is the stage of picking your first faculty position if you go
straight for a postdoc, or unless you decide to get a second postdoc, which a lot of people are doing nowadays. But if you go
for a faculty position, that in the last
year and a half of your postdoc, you really start looking into it and preparing for it.
Thank you so much for your answers, which I'm sure will be very beneficial to our members. And to finish up, I just have one more question that I would like to ask both of you. Reflecting on everything you have achieved in your career so far, what advice would you give to your younger self?
You go first, Lynn.
Oh, that's a hard question.
Assuming
there's anything that you think you should advise your younger self, maybe you just think that your younger self just did everything as they should have, and that's fine as well.
I think in retrospect, I've been really, really fortunate in that regard. I don't know that I did anything that I wouldn't do over again, I suppose. I think one of the challenges is always, because I've always been involved in team science, just to be clear, that it's very easy at times to enter into collaborations that you immediately or down the road recognize are not healthy. In other words, and this is actually particularly challenging in computational biology and bioinformatics, is that sort of your expertise is being used, but you're maybe not being recognized so much for that expertise and the things that you're contributing. So that would be my only caution, is just make sure that if you go for collaborative science, that what you're doing is actually being acknowledged. Yeah, stand your ground, and if not, then, bail. Go a different direction. I think also in light of what we just talked about with respect to different institutions and environments, if you are going to be involved in team science, make sure when you go to interview that that's a place that values team science, because that also means that others have broached that barrier in the pursuit of tenure, and that's a really important attribute that isn't everywhere right now, even today.
Yeah, well, I don't have much to add to that. I've also been very fortunate along my career to be in fantastic places with great mentors, and so I'm fortunate in that regard. Would there be any decision that I would have taken differently career-wise? I don't think so. I think that when I finished medical school, I knew exactly what I wanted to do. So I did the American Embassy exam and I went to the United States. When I finished my fellowship at Johns Hopkins, I thought about staying in the United States versus coming back to Europe. We made the decision as a family to come back to Europe, and I don't regret that. And I think that, in putting together a fantastic breast cancer program in Cambridge, I valued always my colleagues, and like Elaine says, team science and recognizing people. And I think that, if I have one piece of advice, is listen to advice, but then follow your own decisions based on both rational consideration of all the variables and ultimately go with your gut instinct.
Yeah. That's more what I meant with this question.
It wasn't necessarily if you regret
or if you would like to do anything over again differently. More like what advice would you give to your younger self? And I think this has been brilliant advice. And thank you very much, both of you, once again. I'm really sure our listeners are going to be really happy with this episode. And thank you again.
Thank you.
We really hope that you enjoyed listening to Elaine and Carlos's career advice, inspired by their own experiences. Thank you again, Elaine and Carlos, for being here today with me. And many thanks to everyone who listened. Please do us a favor and tell your friends about our podcast. And don't forget to tune in on the 31st of May for the next episode, where together with Professor Greg Hannon, Cancer Grant Challenges grant winner, Dr. Ryan Schoenfeld, CEO of the Mark Foundation, and Dr. Arianna Bagiolini, SNSF Starting Grant winner, we will discuss how to best prepare a funding application for your own research. You can give us feedback or offer suggestions for other topics or preferred guests to our feedback form that you can find on our website at www.eacr.org/podcast. That's www.eacr.org/podcast. Also, on our website at eacr.org, you can find lots of useful information for cancer researchers, such as job opportunities, conferences, free webinars, and our Find a Collaboration tool to help you find collaborators in your research. We're on Twitter at EACR News, Instagram at Hello EACR, and you can search for us on Facebook and LinkedIn.